This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear from the children of parents in the U.S. on work visas. Saivikas Nathy came to Bloomington Normal as a child. His parents are still waiting for green cards, and that doesn't help him.
The main concerning problem for me is that I have to switch to a student visa as soon as I turn 21, which is this coming October.
Nathy loses his in-state tuition status when he switches, and he could eventually be forced to leave the only country he has ever known. Hear from Saivikas and other children of immigrants not in the DACA program about the uncertainty they face. Get reaction from State House candidates and a current lawmaker to the governor's State of the State address, and discover how ISU researchers are helping first responders fight the opioid crisis. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's February 1st, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Governor Bruce Rauner spoke of achievements in a landmark school funding bill during his State of the State speech. He talked about bipartisanship in his annual address shortly before his campaign sent out an attack email to supporters. He talked about many of the same things he has emphasized in the last several years: lower property taxes, economic growth, and workers' compensation reform, but without many specifics on how to make those things attractive to lawmakers who must also wrestle with a $2 to $3 billion imbalance between state revenue and expenditures. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with three people running for the same state house seat in Bloomington Normal this year. First is longtime incumbent 105th District Representative Dan Brady, who is deputy Republican leader in the House. Brady says the tone of the governor's speech was good for the bicentennial year.
Things that are more stable, but much more that's not stable as far as the state of the state goes. And so that was my overall reaction.
The big applause line was about the balanced budget, although there was some snark from Democrats, because there really hasn't been a balanced budget since about 2001 under many administrations. How is that going to happen?
Well, that's going to be incumbent upon the governor and his staff to come up with that. If it's going to be truly a balanced budget and reflect cuts and other aspects of lack of revenue, it's obviously not going to be warmly received. But paring that down, the governor said he was going to present a balanced budget, and that, you know, received a bipartisan applause, obviously. And so it remains to be seen what he will do when here in a couple of weeks when he gives that address.
The governor talks about finding ways to roll back tax increases, and that would seem to run counter to the idea of a balanced budget. Are those things even possible in the same paragraph?
You alluded to the fact of the question of a balanced budget and how many years has it truly been. You can put anything on paper, and then once that blueprint, if you will, is reviewed by appropriations committees and others in the Illinois General Assembly, the proof will be in the pudding if anything's truly balanced in there. Without aspect of revenue and revenue growth, it will be very difficult in which to do. And that's what the governor highlighted in his state. The state was that in those areas of growth, there's been some movement in recruitment. There's been companies like our own Brandt in my legislative district that is located. But overall, there's vast room for improvement, which is going to be that tax and grow that tax base. And that's not going to be accomplished in one budget cycle. It's going to be very difficult, and there's more pain ahead, unfortunately.
What shape will that pain take in the spring legislative session? It is, after all, an election year, and lawmakers may not be willing to inflict too much pain.
Well, I wish that, but it was a state of state, but I wish that we had right now a revenue number that we, Democrats and Republicans, could agree on to move forward with a budget proposal. So that revenue number is going to have to be identified and agreed upon, hopefully. And we need a new budget, a full year's budget again. We need to have a state budget and not revisit what our problems have been in the past in trying to bring a budget together. So, you know, it's going to be very difficult. And as you alluded to, it will be more difficult in an election year, unfortunately, because of the two sides and what they're willing to give or not give in an election year. That will compound the problems that we have.
Last year, depending on whom you talk to, if you talk to Senate President John Cullerton, it was a case of the governor vetoing a legislative compromise. If you talk to Senate Republican leader Bill Brady, it was a case of House Speaker Mike Madigan going off on his own at the 11th hour and 59 minutes and blowing up what could have been a grand bargain that encompassed more than the actual budget resolution that passed did. So is it going to be a similar kind of year, or is the governor going to be relevant to budget negotiations?
Well, I think that it has a recipe to be similar, and that's what we're going to have to guard against. I think that what you'll see is when you talk about some of the things that the governor talked about in the job growth and some of his reforms, and the governor's going to have to identify and know when he's made some of those accomplishments and gotten some things, and that's as good as it's going to get, and come back for a different day, especially during an election year and a budget cycle. That gets back to my point, and my concern is, in particular, the other side of the aisle, the Democrats, not going to be in a mood from a political standpoint that's going to work with the governor. Therefore, that will put things back on the leaders themselves on the rank and file.
So because it's an election year, Democrats won't want to give the governor anything he can point to as an achievement, and that will force you in the House and Senate Republicans into an uncomfortable position to get something done.
Well, you know, no pain, no gain, and it's going to be painful. When you look at the past history of how we came to the budget that we presently do have, it fell back to the leaders in the rank and file. And that recipe, as I said, is still very much on the books. And this time frame of putting together a budget is going to be most difficult in an election year.
State Representative Dan Brady, in spite of his leadership position, Brady faces a primary from the right challenged by David Paul Blumenschein of Bloomington. Blumenschein also speaks with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. He says Governor Rauner is not his first choice to be the next governor. That would be Jeannie Ives, but Rauner is his second choice.
One of the things that really stuck out, yes, he went through a very long list of wonderful attributes of our great state. One of the things he pointed out was that we are the world's 17th largest economy. Now, if we're the 17th largest economy, then how is it that we have the current crisis financially and the credit rating that we've been given by Standard & Poor's? How did we end up here? I mean, that to me is something that really stuck out. I have to agree with him. We don't have a revenue problem. We have a tax and spend problem. So that part of his state of the state, you know, I'm on board with. The other part that I'm very much on board with is put term limits on the ballot and let the people decide. 80% of voters in Illinois.
The governor has never submitted a balanced budget, nor have other governors for many years. But in an election year where lawmakers are reluctant to inflict pain on voters, how can a balanced budget be accomplished?
Well, the interesting thing about that is his own accounting office has said, based on what transpired last July, that we won't be able to have a balanced budget till 2023. Now, I guess I'm confused. What has happened between the last time that his own accounting office reported that and today? He obviously was bold enough to say that he was going to, in the next couple weeks, bring forth a balanced budget. The greatest minds out there in actuarial science say that's not going to happen. We have too many other issues that we have to deal with first. The pensions. We have to start that conversation on how we're going to restructure them. The debt, obviously, the biggest part of the debt is the pensions. You know, we know that we owe a lot of money to a lot of people in Illinois, over $9 billion. We did not do anything to allocate those monies in the last budget. Comptroller Mendoza came out and said, here we are, we're $2 billion. I'm holding $2 billion worth of checks again because we just didn't make the allocations to pay the bills that we owe.
How would you make those allocations?
Well, you know, the complexity of it, Charlie, is pretty great. I've publicly come out and also support a balanced budget plan called the Taxpayer Bargain. And any of your listeners can go to taxpayerbargain.com. That kind of lays it out. You know, reforms, when it comes to pension reforms, has to start with leadership. And that has to start with our legislator pensions. Within the Taxpayer Bargain plan, we will reform legislator pensions before reforming pensions of other state employees. We will end pensions for all new legislators going forward. So, you know, the couple hundred that are currently collecting out of GARS, which is the pension fund for legislators, they're gonna keep their pensions in place. There's a good amount of legislators that are currently holding office. So, yes, they will be added to that grandfathered clause. We need to keep our promises to our current retirees and employees.
That means that much of the pension liability is locked in then.
Well, constitutionally it is, right? So we're going to have to do some things that, you know, we're going to have to get people to sit down to the table. It's not going to go away. I heard or I read something yesterday in regards to a certain legislator that proposed actually bonding $107 billion in order to take care of a lot of the indebtedness. Well, that's just not good common sense to go out and borrow that kind of money just to save some interest. You know, you're just setting yourself up for a continuation, a perpetuation of the same cycle you've been in. We need to go back to looking at some of the, I mean, once again, this is all out there, and it actually includes President John Cullerton's cost and consideration plan. And it moves new state employees to a modern 401k-style pension plan. The public pension cost shifts to schools, universities, local governments in exchange for financial relief from unfunded state mandates. I mean, there is so much out there that because of the partisanship that currently goes on in Springfield, and that's where term limits comes in, we get very little done. The governor hasn't gotten anything done in 3 years.
State House candidate David Paul Blumenschein speaking with GLT's Charlie Schlinker. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy, and you're listening to Reaction to Governor Rauner's State of the State speech. Also in the 105th District, Democrat Ben Webb is running. GLT's Charlie Schlinker talks with Webb, who says he sees parallels between Governor Rauner's speech and President Trump's State of the Union address this week.
It was a message of unity. However, the governor has to accept responsibility for a budget impasse that lasted over 700 days, which has really harmed our public university system. And yet the chapters of history that he's choosing to include in the State of the State are picking and choosing the parts of our history that we're most proud of. And yet we have to look at how we have a exodus of students leaving our state, we have jobs leaving our state, and as much as he wants to talk about job creation, we've had years-long budget impasses that need to be accepted, and there needs to be some responsibility for the gridlock that has been happening in Springfield.
Isn't that what politicians do, though? They accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, and point to where they've had success?
I would say that's part of what politicians do, and I think that's why you're seeing so many candidates right now who have never held office before and never even thought about going into politics, feeling activated and empowered to get involved in this process. The governor even talked about how we need to deal with the corrupt politics that we have in our state that is kind of turning our state and what's happening at the national level as well, is kind of numbing us to what is to be expected by politicians and by government. But I also would kind of mention that he's speaking of unity, but a few days ago he was also talking about how we need to deal with the corruptness of government. And so as many vetoes as we've had from this governor, it comes back to accountability.
Your prospective opponent in the fall, Representative Dan Brady, suggests that this will be a difficult budget year. He projects that Democrats will not want to give Governor Rauner anything in the way of a success that he can hang his hat on to make the case for reelection, and so the task of creating a budget will fall to the rank and file lawmakers and Senate and House leaders instead. Your perspectives on that?
I do think this midterm is going to be unlike many others, because there was actually standing ovation and laughter when I was watching the video of the State of the State after the fact when he said that there will be a balanced budget in February. And the laughter, it's just kind of interesting that we're going to return to this conversation. And part of what I'm unsure about and what I'm kind of concerned about is on the 14th, when the budget proposal goes forth from the executive branch's office, what's going to be cut and what will be given away? The last few budgets, as well as the school funding formulas that have been near and dear to me as an educator, a lot of times there have been those red lines where Democrats and Republicans say, this is unacceptable. We will not pass if this happens. For this most recent school funding and school funding bill, it was private school vouchers. And so I'm curious, in this next budget, what is going to be cut? Because right now we are dealing with a university system that has been crippled due to a lack of funding. We have students who are leaving our university system, and tuition dollars are just not coming in the same way because we have people and jobs leaving our state. And so I'm curious what's going to be cut in this system, because there has not been the compromise that the State of the State was saying we're going to find, that unity that we're going to have. And oftentimes the veto power that he holds, it puts some of our essential structures into jeopardy.
How should the governor have framed his speech, in your view?
There were a couple of talking points that, and I've watched it more than once, there were a couple of talking points I was happy that he addressed. The Me Too movement, the addressing of how we have an environment of sexism and harassment. I think that the governor was smart to include that. But I also think that there needs to be the approach of investment. He talks about how our property taxes are too high, but we need to have the conversation about how in our state we have a fixed tax rate when it comes to income taxes. We need to look at how comparatively our sales tax to neighboring states is absolutely different. And in some cases, it's half. And so we need to have that conversation because we have a number of senators who are pushing right now for a constitutional amendment that would allow a graduated tax, a progressive tax, so that those at the top are paying their fair share and the middle class bank accounts that the governor even addresses in his speech, they're being drained right now because they're doing everything they can to provide for the public good. It's more about how we all can provide for the public good, and we, in fact, are providing our fair share.
Democrat Ben Webb, a candidate for state representative in Bloomington Normal, speaking with Charlie Schlenker. You also heard from State Representative Dan Brady and his primary challenger, David Paul Blumenschein, all reacting to Governor Rauner's State of the State address. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, a grant-making organization committed to helping you meet your philanthropic goals through donor advice funds, endowments, scholarships, and more. More information at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The opioid epidemic has police officers facing a number of potentially dangerous drugs on the street. Recently, emergency responders found an overdose victim in Bloomington who used heroin mixed with carfentanil, which can be easily absorbed on contact. A team of Illinois State University researchers has received a nearly $300,000 grant from the National Institute of Justice to continue work on a device for on-site testing of drugs with a level of accuracy currently only available in laboratories. For a closer look at the science, WGLT's Colleen Reynolds sat down with chemistry professors June Hun and Kim and Jeremy Driscoll.
So the original grant was actually awarded to our colleague Dr. Mulligan and Dr. Whelan, and they focused on developing an instrument to identify drugs with a portable on-site capabilities. And the new push is to integrate an additional technique so that we can use two completely independent techniques on-site for identification. And that has big implications as far as the evidence being admissible for court requires two independent approaches to identify drugs rather than one.
As I understand it, there is a second sort of technology that will serve as a check on the first.
Yes, actually, each technology has already been fairly well established, and portable capabilities are already available to researchers and law enforcement communities. But each one right now operates independently. So there is a single instrument that is used for one technology or one technique, and a completely different instrument that is used for the other technology. Each one of them have been established as being very informative in terms of identifying drugs. In fact, they're both classified as Category A, which is the best, most accurate technique. But again, it's really recommended to properly identify with high accuracy two independent methods in order for it to be upheld in a court of law. So what we're really trying to do is take these two established technologies that have already proven themselves independently and basically put them together, integrate them onto one system, one instrument, and so we can simultaneously basically do both techniques at the same time to independently get hopefully the same answer in terms of identification. And if we have two independent identifications, then it's much more accurate in terms of identifying and holding up in a court of law.
Professor Kim, if you describe the spectrometer, it's not very big.
Right. The previous project was basically using paper type materials and swapping on the surface to detect drug molecules. And we are incorporating nanoscale materials onto it. By doing it, we can increase the surface area. By doing it, we can have more drug molecules can be adsorbed on the surface. And then that substrate can be utilized with the two techniques at the same time.
So, Professor Driscoll, I'm trying to,
right,
for the average person who doesn't understand,
sure,
chemistry.
It turns out for the second technique that we're using, called Raman spectroscopy, it takes a much higher concentration or a lot more of the chemical in order to detect it. And so by using Dr. Kim's approach to basically load these nanomaterials, nanoparticles, onto the paper, we're not making the paper necessarily any bigger in terms of its area or what we're handling, but if you zoom in very close, the surface area is much greater than the paper by itself. So there's more locations, more surface for those molecules to adsorb onto. And gold nanoparticles or silver nanoparticles that Dr. Kim is working with also have some other properties that will enhance the signature, enhance the signal that we detect using Raman spectroscopy, that second technique. So now, not only do we have more molecules on that swab, it actually acts to enhance the signal so that we can detect smaller amounts of material.
Simply, you can think about packing a materials in a small surface, in a jar, for example, packing a sand versus a rock. You can pack more stuff with the sand. That's kind of idea of using that surface.
There are some simple handheld drug field tests that are out there, but now that we're getting into all of this and that opioids and the mixing of heroin with other types of synthetics, I'm guessing the sooner police know they're dealing with, the better, Professor Driscoll?
That's absolutely true. And a lot of those field tests that you're talking about or you referred to, they are active toward a particular class of compound. So there's not a lot of specificity involved with that. So similar molecules could both result in a positive, or if there's a slight structural change, a lot of the new synthetic drugs, if there's a slight structural change, it may lead to a false negative. The current field tests are primary screening to send it back to the lab for further testing. But the techniques that we're developing, ideally, they will provide the specificity and the sensitivity that it won't require transportation back to a reference lab. We can do all of it right there on site.
So does the Department of Justice give you parameters as you look for accuracy of the tests with this particular device?
They have not defined that. At this point in the research, it's really about establishing what our capabilities are before we decide whether or not it provides the accuracy that's required for legal purposes. So at this point, we're just exploring what our accuracy is. I can tell you that for the Raman spectroscopy that I mentioned that it's already independently been validated, its accuracy is a little over 97% for the drug molecules that have been tested based on other NIJ funded research. And I think the mass spec is slightly better than that because it can typically detect lower levels of material. When we add the nanoparticles in there, we hope that we can improve that accuracy even greater than 97%. And then when we combine both techniques together, we have two completely independent methods of identifying a chemical, the accuracy can probably go up from there.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Colleen Reynolds, talking with Illinois State University chemistry faculty members Jeremy Driscoll and Joon-Hung Kim, who are using a nearly $300,000 grant from the National Institute of Justice to come up with a device that will better identify suspicious substances at crime scenes, so much so that they might not ever need to send it off to a lab. Are there other uses for this kind of a device beyond law enforcement?
I would say absolutely. The technology, again, independently, each of these techniques have already been used for military operations, explosives detection, those sorts of uses. And again, if we can combine two techniques, that would just increase the accuracy of detection in those sorts of applications as well.
Professor Kim, the other part of the equation is not only admissibility in court, but if you're going to have a law enforcement application, it's also going to be cost. Are you including that within your research?
Right. The material that we're thinking about designing is a relatively, like, really cheap because everything is paper-based. The paper is also made out of cellulose. And also, we are thinking about using a polymer-based nanofiber systems, which is just the price of a cellulose range. So we're, in terms of cost-wise, we don't really have to worry about just compared to the conventional substrate.
Would that include recycled paper then?
Recycled paper, that's correct.
In taking a look at the spectrometer device that is widely used and widely available, it does seem to be kind of clunky, and it almost looks like something that belongs in the Smithsonian. Do you see this as something that police departments would easily be able to transport, and do you envision it eventually getting smaller like all technology, Professor Driscoll?
Yeah, I think we can always think about our instruments shrinking as we move forward. In its current version, the instrument, the size is limited by the mass spectrometer. So the mass spectrometer, which was funded in the original grant, it weighs 90-something pounds, but it's easily loaded in the back of a pickup or a van. The Raman spectrometer, they're less than a pound, so they will be easily added on the front end of a mass spec and very little difference in the overall size or weight of the instrument.
Will they operate independently?
So they will operate independently from one another, but they will be on the same frame. The Raman spectroscopy requires shining a laser on the sample, and the mass spec requires turning on a potential or a voltage. We hope that we can do both of these things at the same time, but we're also have the capabilities of doing one followed by the other for sequential analysis, but either way, it should still be pretty rapid.
Where do you begin with all of this?
Since Dr. Mulligan has established the portable mass spec in a previous grant, I think a lot of the initial research is going to be in Dr. Kim's lab with fabricating these nanoparticles and loading them onto the paper. And then in my lab, our students are working on applying drug molecules, swabbing them with these nanoparticle embedded papers to see what levels of detection we get. So in other words, what's the smallest amount of material that we can detect using the Raman spectroscopy, or technique number two. We also need to make sure that we make the papers, that we're fabricating them in-house in our research labs, that we can make them reproducibly and get similar results each time that we produce these papers.
Students are really getting an interesting experience with this kind of research. This is high-level stuff.
Yeah, this is a wonderful experience. We have some master students working on this, as well as undergraduate students, and they're involved in all phases of this, from the initial synthesis of nanoparticles in Dr. Kim's lab, to collecting data, to analyzing data and statistics, but then they, going back to making it exciting, I mean, I think that the end goal and getting to see their work result in identifying these drug molecules, I think that's a big motivating factor for the students as well.
So if some of these are illicit drugs, you have to be very careful with how that's handled.
All of the drugs that we do have in our research labs, they're locked down, so very limited access to those.
And then a final question, and that is, at some point, do you take your prototype and deploy it for testing in the real world using some of our local law enforcement agencies?
Yes, that was actually part of the original grant. I did do some field testing. Dr. Mulligan has some contacts with local law enforcement, so they did do some analysis of some real crime scenes, some evidence that had been collected. And so I would imagine as we start developing and gathering data and testing out our instruments that we develop in lab, that we will kind of end the same sort of approach trying to test this out on real field samples.
Professor Driscoll, Professor Kim, thank you so much for filling us in on the exciting research going on at Illinois State University. I'm Colleen Reynolds.
The research is a team effort involving faculty and students from ISU's business and chemistry departments. A final phase of research using another grant will involve creating a library of identified drugs and easy-to-use software for officers at scenes to use as they test chemicals that are matched against a periodically updated database of illegal drugs or hazardous substances. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
With the new year comes new opportunities. Opportunities to stay in step with what's going on around the world.
These are the largest demonstrations in Iran in nearly...
Opportunities to learn.
The main reason for the surge has to do with global economic conditions.
And opportunities to be surprised.
Kahlua, chocolate syrup, and red Kool-Aid.
All you have to do is listen. Tune into Morning Edition every day.
Here, Morning Edition, Monday through Friday, now starting at 4 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. There's a lot of focus on undocumented immigrants in the U.S., but 1.5 million people are in this country legally in a sort of limbo, waiting for citizenship. And they're people with desirable skills who came to the country to work on H-1B visas. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talked with the children of some of these visa holders. Their chances for a top education are in doubt, as is their future. Anisha Amavarati is 13 and studies at Chittick Junior High. Syvikas Nathy is 20 and goes to the University of Illinois and at Chicago. And Shravia Jayam is 17 and goes to
normal community high school. Charlie Schlenker talks with all three about their future, starting with Shravia.
Me personally, it's education. There's a lot of benefits that I don't get.
Like what?
As to, well, for example, there's a couple of 7-year medical programs that I would like to go to, but I'm not eligible because I don't have a green card. And, I mean, I have the grades and the test scores to go to these colleges, but, you know.
So how will you get into college?
I got into college. I can get into most colleges, but the really good colleges like the Ivy Leagues, if I did want to go there and if I did get accepted, I most likely cannot go because of financial aid. That's another issue because I can't fill out the FAFSA without a Social Security number. So, yeah, and we don't get financial aid without filling out the FAFSA.
Si, you're a little further along in the process. How did you navigate this? You got into a great school. You're studying. You're in your third year. What has been the limiting factor of the green card holdup and the requirement that you take a student foreign visa instead of having a native Social Security number and access to financial aid?
For me, the problem started also when I was going into college for my admissions. So the process for me was all the colleges I got into many out-of-state, out-of-Illinois colleges, but a lot of them I couldn't go to because they were too expensive and I could not get financial aid also for those. And so I was to choose a college within Illinois because of the money limit. And right now, as I'm further along in the college I am at, the main concerning problem for me is that I have to switch to a student visa as soon as I turn 21, which is this coming October. And when I turn 21 this October, I'm going to have to switch to a student visa. And at that point, I would have to pay the international fees that I get instead of the in-state tuition that I pay now. And this will hinder me. This will make it harder for me to continue higher education also because I can't get student loans either because of this limit.
Even now you can't get student
loans? Even now I can't get student loans.
Will you be able to finish out your education once you turn 21?
I'm hoping so.
It's not a certainty?
I mean, as of now, nothing's certain for me.
Okay. Anisha, when did you come to this country?
I came in 2005 when I was 5 months old.
So you haven't lived any other place for extended periods of time?
No.
Okay. So you're, for all intents and purposes, an American,
yes.
Culturally.
Yeah.
But not by citizenship.
Yes.
How does that make you feel?
Well, I'm doing everything else like an American. I go to school with American kids. I do everything else like American kids, but just the fact that I'm not considered American kind of makes me a little sad.
Your dad and mom are here on what kind of visas?
They're on H-1 dependent visas.
Mm-hmm. And are they feeling uncertain about the ability to stay?
Yes, they are, because it'll take almost 70 years to get the green card. Right now.
Was there great concern when the Trump administration was talking about ending the ability of people to stay in this country while a green card was pending if their H-1B visa had expired? Did that surface at the dinner table?
Yeah, a little bit. We usually didn't go that deep into that, like at the dinner table, but usually my parents had those types of conversations. We mostly talked about how all of my education is also going to be affected because I'm an eighth grader right now. So because I'll be a freshman next year, I'll only have 3 more years to apply for colleges. And as he said, I will have the same problems that they're facing.
Shravia, were there concerns and conversations in your family about the H-1B visa exception to the green card waiting ending?
Yeah, a little bit. My parents seemed to be a little concerned at the dinner table. We were mostly concerned about, like, my education, because if my parents had to leave the country and I was still, you know, in college, I would have to live here by myself, and that's not fun.
You are all culturally American. If the immigration situation remains very clouded, how do you feel about the possibility that you would eventually be required to go back to India?
That's a really scary thought, because we've been living here like almost all our lives, and going to India would be like going to a new country because of how acclimated we are to this environment. So, yeah.
Have you been to India?
I have, yeah.
Saib?
Oh, yeah, I have been to India, and that is a very scary thought. It has been in my mind for a very long time, and I have been here since I was third grade, and I am very accustomed to all the U.S. culture. And the fact is, it would be a completely new life if I do go back there, and I'd have to restart pretty much everything I've gained here.
Same with me. I'd have to restart. It's a new country. Well, because I've been here most of my life, it'll be a new country for me, and everything's going to be different, and I will also be in the middle of my education here, and I'll have to start over on my education, too, because there everything's different.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with the children of Indian tech workers who are themselves culturally American, who've lived here for years and years, but whose immigration status is clouded because of the long-term deadlock in green cards and in H-1B visas. How much has the situation been a limiting factor in what you are choosing to pursue as an education? Sai, let's start out with you. What are you studying, and what might you have chosen to study otherwise?
I'm studying computer science right now. I'm a third-year student. What I could have chosen, I do not know yet, but computer science basically has been chosen for me because it is one of the easier ways to gain It is one of the easier ways for me to gain what I want in the future, and like, it's just a secure life.
So, with that kind of job, there are going to be jobs here for you that are accessible, even if you are forced to go on an H-1B visa.
Yes, yes, exactly.
What might you have chosen?
I just have not thought of that in general. I mean, any possibility would future would have been anything. If everything was accessible for me, maybe business, maybe medicine, maybe even art.
You didn't even bother, though, with that because you knew the limits.
Yes.
Shravia?
I know that as a kid, I wanted to go into law enforcement, and that's a huge thing because you have to be a U.S. citizen to be a lawyer. You need to be a U.S. citizen to be a police officer or any sort of, you know, law enforcement stuff. And I couldn't go into that because of this huge limitation. My second choice was to, go into medical school, so that's what I'm looking into now.
Can you become a doctor?
Yeah, that's a huge question. Well, we talked to a couple colleges. They accept international students, but there's a couple, like Case Western, for example, that doesn't, accept international students, and that's a great medical college, and that's something I'm missing out on.
Anisha, it's a little unfair at age 13 to ask you about your course of study. You're not supposed to have to decide yet. Do you have ideas?
Well, I want to go into medicine, but I don't know if that's going to be possible in another 5 years from now or 4 years from now, because most of the top-rated colleges probably won't accept my applications.
How many young people like you folks are there in this community, which has had a huge presence from India because of State Farm's contractors for decades now? How much does this get talked about at your school lunch tables, at the movie nights, or hanging out?
At our school lunch table, we talk about it a lot compared to other things, because, I mean, me and my friends, we do talk a lot about our education and things, so we do talk about green card and how we're not going to be able to do most of the things that we want to do in the future.
Who says what?
Well, I want to go into medicine. One of my other friends, she wants to be a lawyer, but she has to change her mind because, as I said earlier, it's going to take about 70 years to get the green card. And if it takes 70 years, she's not going to be able to become a lawyer at all.
Sai?
I mean, I do have a lot of friends that are in the same situation as me. I mean, friends that are my age pretty much too. And it is a big concern. We do talk about it quite a bit. And it just concerns our future. And I have another friend who's also in computer science with me. And he's in the same exact situation. His father's an H-1B visa. He's a dependent. He has to switch to a student visa. And both of us just talk about our possibilities, what we have to do if we switch to student visa, what we're going to do about the money situation. And it's just, I don't know, both of us had our paths chosen in a way also, and it's a common issue with people in our situation.
And let's turn to Shravia.
I have a couple of friends who are in the same boat as me. I know, like, one of my friends. He is the top of our class. He's going to be valedictorian soon. But he won't be able to reap the same benefits as his fellow U.S. citizens, which is kind of unfair because of how well he's doing at school.
How much is this going to limit your lives, do you think, if it's not changed in the next year or so?
A huge amount, definitely.
It's not just going to limit. It's just going to make us... aside from just limiting, it's just going to concern for us for a very long time in our lives. And it's just something that we have to deal with aside from just thinking about our future. And it's just more to bear.
Yeah, it's always just going to hang over our heads. And we're going to have to deal with this as adults, always renewing our visas, just living on the edge, because we're always going to be like fearing, going back to...
As of now, my dad does a lot of the documentations or whatever it is that's required when it comes to H-1B. But, I mean, after I switch to a student visa and maybe an H-1 after that, it's just I'm going to have to do that too. And, I mean, it's just more work that has to be put upon yourself.
It's hard enough doing FAFSAs and
paying taxes and in general.
It's hard enough managing the paperwork of ordinary life, let alone huge government bureaucracies. How much of it have you been exposed to? You said your dad has done a lot of it, but surely he's, like any dad, he's preparing you to take it up yourself.
As I have grown older and as of now, I'm doing it with him, and like he's asking me questions and I'm asking him questions, and he's being more straightforward with me on our situation. And he is preparing me, yes, for in case I need to do this too in the future. And he's showing me all the documentation, giving me everything to do also.
How much is it?
It's quite a bit. It's just a lot of papers. You have to just go through a lot of your information. For me especially, I have to bring back records of my like even elementary school stuff. Go through every grade I even got and like. It's just all my background history, everything I've done since maybe third grade.
It sounds like that's a lot of pressure. I mean, normally you throw away elementary school grades when you get to high school, but you're saying you can't even do that.
No, you have to keep everything.
Yeah.
I haven't personally seen my dad file anything or file any immigration paperwork, but I've seen him do taxes and stuff. And the thing is, we pay the same amount of taxes as any other U.S. citizen, but again, we don't get Social Security benefits and stuff, and that's kind of unfair. So.
Is it withdrawn from paychecks?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Have you seen hopeful signs that there will be a shift on immigration reform, on green card reform?
I haven't really heard anything that might make a change yet.
The Trump administration backtracked on the intent to end the policy that allows people who've applied for green cards to stay even if their F-1B visas expire. Do you find that reassuring or not?
I mean, that is reassuring in a way, but it's not secure as it should be.
It's not progress. It's
basically the same thing. I mean, what they did was they were like, oh, we'll take that renewal away from them. Oh, you know what? We'll just give it back to them. So it's the same thing over and over again, and not much progress is being made.
Yeah, it just seems really bleak, especially in the Trump administration. He seems to be anti-immigrant, and that's really worrisome for all of us.
Shravia Jayam is 17 and attends Normal Community High School. Anisha Amavarati is 13, a student at Chittick Junior High. And Sivakas Nathy is 20 and wrapping up at the University of Illinois at Chicago. They all talked with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the interviews from Charlie Schlenker and Colleen Reynolds at our website, WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast or look for it at iTunes. We want your feedback. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.